she inspires, educates, and informs. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. I am Gina Murphy Darling, and you are listening to Mrs. Green's World, an inspirational and informative place where we never tell you what to think. We just want you to. Thanks so much for joining us and for being a part of Mrs. Green's World. And as always, a big thanks to one of our amazing partners for this show in particular, the Chapman Automotive Group. They have such a strong commitment to sustainable practices in all of their dealerships, including their support of their big Community Green team. They most recently, their Honda facility received a platinum level Honda Environmental Leadership Award for reductions of 50% in energy usage. And they were one of only 14 dealers in the country to be given this award in recognition of their sustainability programs. Chapman, thank you for your support and for all you do for our community and for the planet. So now everybody take a deep breath, get ready, just really get ready for a force. The force is with us, and her name is Vien Trong. She is unbelievable. We have to tweet that, Vien. The force is with us. I would like to extend a very warm welcome to you and thank you for being here and tell you a little bit about her role and the director. She's the director of Green for All, which is a social justice accelerator, and I want everybody to listen to every one of these intentional words for transformative campaigns, ideas, and innovations. This organization is really all about accelerating transformation, in my opinion. They are a national initiative dedicated to building an inclusive green economy strong enough to lift people out of poverty. And that, just that, I kept underlining that, strong enough to lift people out of poverty, because from where I sit, then we all win. She works tirelessly to bring equity, social justice, and climate justice to the front lines of the conversational movement and to public policy. She has been a central force in putting environmental justice at the center of California's groundbreaking climate policy, legislation, and cap and trade funding. In short, again, Vien Trong is a force. It's very exciting to have you here. And I was salivating at Bioneers. I'm writing and putting stars next to your name and saying, Kelly, we have to get Vien to be a guest on the Mrs. Green's World show. And here you are.
Well, that's really kind, Gina. Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
It is so well deserved. It's way beyond kind. It's like we need more you. And you're helping to inspire leadership. And I know there are a lot of other people in your organizations and a lot of us that are really being a stand for change. You and I talked a little bit before the show, and I think in your case, your personal journey, it didn't only lead you to recognize, but become intensely involved with organizations who not only, you know, get people living in poverty out, and in marginalized communities, they've been overlooked and for the most part excluded from any climate change conversation. So you are fiercely and passionately committed to changing that. What happened in the evolution of Vien and your personal journey that got you where you are today?
Yeah, well, my family and I'm the youngest of 11 kids, and my family and I got here in the early 80s as refugees, because there was a war in Vietnam, and we had to get out and get some space. So we got here, and we became farm laborers in Portland, Oregon. My mom would strap me to her back and pick strawberries and snow peas on the fields. And that's where what we did for years. And so turns out my grandma was becoming unhealthy. She was getting sick, and then she started getting dementia. So we moved to Oakland and began doing work in sweatshops. And that's what we did from the time I was a kid until the time I went to college. It's what my parents and my siblings and then eventually I began doing. And through that process, what I saw was there was a connection to what was happening on farmlands and what was happening in urban centers. There was increasing kind of disenfranchisement of people who were suffering at the very bottom. And I wanted to do something about that. And that's what leads me to doing the work I do today, which is connecting not only the climate problems, but also the economy problem.
And, you know, you think, you know, you even use the word sweatshops, and we don't even, a lot of us don't even think of the idea of having sweatshops in our country and marginalized communities and, you know, kind of those dirty little secrets, which with transparency, fortunately, are coming out a lot more. But here it was in our own country, not 100 years ago, right? Not 100 years ago, you know, very recently. So Green for All, just give us a brief overview of what it actually does and how you get people engaged.
Green for All is working to build a green economy strong enough to lift people out of poverty. So what it means is we basically work on solutions to solve poverty and pollution. And we do that at the federal, state, and local levels. And we've done everything from helping to pass the first ever Green Jobs Act in 2007 to helping to create solutions for Flint, for families who are in the rural communities, for people who are in coal country, and just everywhere in between.
And it's when you, what do you explain to people when they say, what do you mean a marginalized community? What is that? And why do you focus on that? A lot of people don't even know what that is.
Yeah, it's the communities that have been left stranded or left to defend for themselves. It's families and communities that have been at the margins of society, areas that have a lot of polluting facilities, that live near highways and freeways. Their schools are underinvested in. It's failing our kids. They don't have a reliable healthcare system. There's no jobs, and there's no thriving economies, and so people are left really living paycheck to paycheck. Those are the communities to play for.
They have had no voice when it comes to the conversation about climate change. It does affect us all. For the most part, have people in marginalized communities been excluded from the conversation? And don't they have more reasons to fight for climate change than many, many other people, especially in our country?
Yeah, because they're the front lines, and so their lives are impacted more than anybody else's. But if you're a family who's trying to just make ends meet, not sure if you can afford to pay for the head of broccoli versus paying for the new shoes for your kids, it's hard for you to have the time to go and sign petitions and go and march in the streets and go and testify in hearings. And we get that because there are the immediate needs. So we want to make sure that we're hearing what's happening and fighting for the solutions that they need. And for example, one of the times when we started seeing a policy happen in California around electric transportation, well, it's an issue that most people don't think about, right? Especially if you're living in areas that are so poor, you can't even afford a new car, much
right,
less an electric
right.
car. And so what I and my friends and my organization did is we went out to the rural communities and we said, hey, there's this policy coming down. And the thing is, when you're poor, a lot of times policy happens to you and on you, and it doesn't incorporate your voice. And so we went out and said, this is happening, but tell us, what are the transportation problems in your community and what can we help do about it? And what we heard in rural areas is that they don't have a reliable bus system. They don't have opportunities or choices around whether to rely on their clunker or their broken bus system. And what we helped to create was a van pool system that allowed for the people in the community to get into a clean electric van that essentially served as an informal car sharing program in the community. And that is now, they're getting 200 electric vehicles now in this rural community in Huron. But that's all because we go out in the community and we listen and ask what's needed.
I think the first part of that is, what a concept. You actually ask people what they need instead of telling them what would be good for them. It's like, come on, people. They know. It's not, it always just blows me away. I did a lot of work in home-based services. And instead of going in and telling families how we would fix them, we ask them, what can we do to help? What are some of your barriers to, you know, getting your kids to school or being late or jobs? And they know. They don't need therapy. They know. They need help.
Right. They know their problem more than anybody. And arguably, they know how to count dollars and cents better than anybody because they have to in order to make ends meet every month, right? And so when we start by saying, listening to the experts of the problem, then we can begin co-creating a solution.
And when you talk about, I mean, sometimes I don't go into the depth that I should about some of the terms we use, because maybe I know a little bit more after doing it, but you certainly know. Talk about what a strong green economy would look like, and maybe throw in there why it is so vastly different from a fossil fuel economy, which, you know, was there even this, not, I didn't say a strong fossil fuel economy, the operative word being fossil, but what does a strong green economy look like? What would that be?
Well, imagine if we didn't have to worry about stepping outside of our homes and the air was so clean that you didn't have to worry about bringing your asthma inhaler. Imagine that amount of kids carrying asthma inhalers to school dropped by half, and maybe half even more. Imagine if you don't have to pay high electricity bills, but instead have solar panels or wind power that makes it almost free for families who are suffering at the very bottom of the income ladder. Imagine if the jobs that are putting the solar panels up on the rooftops or the windmills up on the farms are done by local community members, and they pay good wages. These are above ground jobs, not underground and in coal mines, but jobs that give you dignity and help build and power the future of America. That's what a green economy looks like.
It's the line that I use and have used for a long time. How about a world that works for everyone? Because then it really does work for everyone. There's a big history maker that you were a part of that is part of the impetus behind Green for All, and I maybe in some ways has allowed you to do what you've done, but it's the passing of SB 535 in California, and I call it the cleanup or pay up bill. What does the bill actually do? And what I'm curious about is, how did you ever get it passed?
Cleanup or pay up bill requires that big polluters, like the refineries and the power plants and the large manufacturers, begin to clean up the amount of poison they put into the air. And they are put on a timeline. And if they can't meet the timeline, then they have to pay up for the amount that they go over the requirement. So clean up or pay up around that. And then that extra amount that gets paid into a pot of funds, that gets used directly for things that reduce pollution and create good jobs. And so what me and my friends helped to do was say, let's put aside a 35% amount of that fund for the areas that really need it most. And that 35% has been used to create a total approximately $2 billion of public money, of private leverage money, of other funds. And that, in the first year, has helped to create nearly 2,000 solar panels, number of public transportation programs, affordable housing, energy efficiency, trees in communities that are just deserts right now, a bunch of other good stuff.
And I'm curious, how do you decide where that money goes? You know what I mean? How is it distributed, and are there restrictions on it can't be used on certain things? How do you decide, or what's the governance behind that to make sure it's responsive to the needs of the community where the changes are being implemented?
Yeah. Well, first, we don't decide. It's the people of California who decide. And there's a law that requires that all of this money has to be spent in programs that actually do reduce pollution. So that's a basic criteria. And then after the law was passed, we went to churches and town halls and community centers, and we did webinars and conference calls. We did a number of things for a year trying to get input from everybody as much as possible, just getting feedback from a diversity of people in California. And the things that the community members told us was kind of deduced and synthesized so that it set into what were the programs that worked that met the needs of the people that were telling us what they wanted. And everything that community said that they wanted, we got funded, fully funded.
And can you give us a couple of examples? Because I did listen to some of them on YouTube. So give us a couple of examples of one community or two that this is what they said they wanted, this is what you did, and how it brought about what I call systemic change.
Yeah, you know, the one that I like most Huron, and so I mentioned it earlier, but I want to unpack that a little more because it's so innovative. When we went to Huron, one of the lead organizers there said, the problem that we have is we have one of the highest asthma rates in the country. One out of four of our kids have asthma. One out of four. And in order for us to get to the children's hospital in the city, it takes us 3 hours on the bus each way and 3 hours back. But if you miss the bus, then you have to go to the retiree who's sitting in the diner who has a station wagon. And for $65 and the price of his meal, he will take you to the children's hospital. But if he's gone, then you're lost. I mean, that's the system they have, right? So we took that and said, how can we figure this out? If we gave all the money to public transportation program, it would just get absorbed, right? And so that was where we said, what if we created something that was like a van pool that can be driven by a few people who have access to it, who have licenses, and they can create an informal bus system around the city, around the rural community. And if they need to go to the hospital or if they need to go to the grocery store, if they need to make runs to another place in the city, then they can do that. And just recently, we got them 200 of those van pools that they can now use to create a new system.
And these are people, when you talk about, the low income, the marginalized community, whatever, the whole disadvantage, a lot of times, these are not people that have paid leave. They don't have sick leave. They don't have benefits. If they don't work, they don't get paid. So it just makes it all that much worse. It's a multiplier of hardship on a family with a sick child. I certainly know that one.
Yeah.
So what about, let's pick a hot topic, a really hot topic, because I have a couple of them for you because you have your finger on the pulse. Let's talk about Flint, Michigan. I call it a disgrace of epic proportions. And how did you get involved and help really raise the awareness? It was like putting a real spark there. I mean, there was a lot of attention, but there was an organized effort on the part of Green for All to get everybody to focus front and center.
Mm-hmm. Well, I found out about it the way most people did, which is on the news.
Right.
And I was driving in the car with my kids and started hearing the story unfold, and just my heart stopped. And I thought about the families who had little kids who were lead poisoned. There is 10,000 kids in Flint, and ostensibly all of them have been poisoned. So I just couldn't not do anything. And I didn't know what to do or what the right thing to do was. And all I could figure out was, well, let me just call somebody and say, I'm here. Can I help do anything? Not a huge organization, but, what we have is yours to use. And what they told us is, already the journalists are saying, oh, that was the story of the time. Let's move on. Let's have calls and their election. Everything that Trump was saying that was, incendiary. And then, so we said, yeah, we can help with that. We put together a bus tour in just a little over a week. Van Jones and Mark Ruffalo and Tom Steyer, 12 media outlets from MSNBC and CNN to others that came on the bus and just went to listen to what was happening in Flint. And they covered the stories of mothers who had miscarriages because of the water and the lead in the water. Parents who had to hear their kids scream because of their skin breaking out in rashes from the water and the cracking that it caused on their skin when they were trying to take a bath. We were hearing about the undocumented community there that had no access to the hospital and can only go to the clinic 3 times a year and had no preventative measure and no documentation and couldn't see help. And families whose homes now are completely worthless. So it cost $10,000 to replace the pipes in the home. They couldn't sell their homes now because it's illegal to sell a house with lead pipes. And so now they're stranded and stuck in a house that has water, and they have to keep paying for the water because it's illegal not to pay your bill. And then they can't move away from their homes, and all the business and industries have left because they can't attract any more tourists or visitors. And so, homes in Flint, I would say, it wasn't just poisoned. They were robbed. And we went out there and said, story must be covered. So I'm happy to say we helped bring funding to, all of the things that we did was completely for free. You know, we had no funding for ourselves. We just said it was in a case of emergency. Let's get out there and do something. And then we were able to find some additional funders to help families there. I mean, literally, people were giving family members just a check.
Like, we have to finish more of this conversation when we get back. Really, I have more questions about Flint, Michigan. Everybody, please stay here with me. Vian Trong, Director of Green for All. We've got lots more important topics to cover. Stay here with us.
Join us for a new on-demand podcast every week at MrsGreensWorld.com. Listen on your computer or mobile device using the iHeartRadio or SoundCloud mobile apps. We are a proud member of the iHeartRadio, Glimmerglass, and Speak Up networks. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. Stay in touch with information about healthy living, sustainability, contests, and events by signing up for our e-newsletter on our website. If you have questions or comments about the show, write to us at info@MrsGreensWorld.com. We'd love to hear from you. But right now, back to Mrs. Green.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. Thanks for being with us. Joining us for this hour is Vian Trong. She is the director of Green for All, a national initiative to build an inclusive green economy strong enough to lift people out of poverty. And I just want to mention again that she is clearly one who understands what it actually takes to get people out of poverty and the kinds of support they need to do just that. She helped pass SB 535 in California, which directs 35% of California's greenhouse gas reduction fund to disadvantaged communities. And as I said, the force is with us. I mean, Vian, we have to remember that. When I meet you, I'm going to say, there is the force, because we need people like you out there making things happen more than ever before. So let's go back to Flint, Michigan. You know, when you talk about it, you said, you know, we're a very small organization, but you did happen to mention that you rallied, you know, Van Jones, who's the founder, and Mark Ruffalo and CNN. So you created quite a stir to literally shine a spotlight on this situation, which was pretty much being ignored, minimized. I mean, how could that happen? Nobody cared.
I think people cared, but a lot of us don't know what to do.
Right.
Big. For me, it felt like there comes a time when the silence is betrayal, and I just could not be silent. I didn't know what to do exactly, and I've helped to pass over 20 laws in the last 10 years, and still, you know, there's nothing that prepares you for the problem like this. And you just show up, and I'm here. What can I do? Put me to work. Can I help pick up trash? Can I help hold your hand? Can I help make some calls on, you know, families to the senators? What can I help? And I think more than anything, this country now needs compassion and just people reaching out and say, how can I help? That's what we did. And it was important, I will say, that we did, because it turns out a few months later, just this past Christmas time, I found out my community had lead poisoning that was worse than Flint. And what happened is scared me. Respond very swiftly and quickly.
How did you find out?
It was a national story, and people knew that I was at work in Flint, and they immediately just swamped my Facebook with, Vian, you have to know that this is in the news. Flint was poisoned because of lead water. We had it because of paint and in our buildings, but the levels in the kids' bloodstreams were higher than they were in Flint. So we convened community meetings, we tagged and met with our elected officials. We rallied the state people onto the federal people and down. We got to work.
And so going back to Flint, Michigan, not only, you know, like their homes are worthless, that's true. No, who's going to buy a house in that affected area for Flint, Michigan? But the bigger issue is, up to and including today, what about clean water and access to clean water? I mean, some of the specials I watched on that, what are they doing? I mean, you can't take a bath, you can't take a drink of water, you can't cook. What are they doing now, many of those families? What's been the solutions that have worked?
That's still mostly the case. The good news is some people have come together, labor union, the activists, have come together and begun to change out some of these pipes. That's slow and moving. There are some state funds, but again, that's very little and not enough to cover the amount of work needed. What we're trying to do right now is to say, well, how do we do financing to replace the pipes? The way that they do financing for solar panels, why don't we do that for the lead pipes in Flint? Seems to be an elegant solution, and that's what we're working on right now.
Okay, so that is, I mean, and that's a lasting solution, and it's just, it's not to be believed. You just read this and you think, well, that was a made-for-TV movie, only it's so real and so devastating. What about the long-term health for the children? What does their future look like in terms of impact of lead poison, you know, lead being poisoned by lead?
Yeah, and I want to be a little sincere. Nobody, you know, anybody who's listening from Flint should know that our hearts go out for them. And it's scary to think of kids being permanently brain damaged because of the lead in their water.
Right.
And so we try to stay away from conversations that are scary.
Right, right.
Focus on some of the solutions, which is kids need to eat leafy greens and vegetables that help to take away the symptoms and that help to keep the lead poisoning low and take out some of the lead from their systems as much as possible. However, not a grocery store in Flint. And so, you know, that is some of the indication of us, what, when you say marginalized communities look and feel like, that's exactly what it looks and feels like. You know, no fresh fruits and vegetables, communities that are not getting the help they need, and not getting the necessary resources to figure out economic and environmental solutions.
You know, I just remember this, you know, have flashbacks of going, driving with my friend Steve Ritz, the Green Bronx Machine, who's working on unbelievably innovative and creative solutions for food in the South Bronx. And he drove us down the strip for a couple of miles. And, you know, Vian, there was not one restaurant that was not a fast food chain. And I mean not one. And we went very slowly and goes, Gina, I just want you to see this. So there was not only no natural food markets or Whole Foods or any of those things, the access to food to eat out was junk food, damaging food, you know, compromised food supply and all those things. And I just have to ask you, there's a little bit of feedback that I'm getting in the feed. So I don't know if there's anything going on with your phone or if it's us, but it's, I just want to try to mitigate that because what you're saying is so important. Let's go on to another hot topic, so hot topic and getting hotter and hopefully not sadder. What is your involvement and assessment? I mean, just talk to me about the Dakota Access Pipeline. You know, to me, another blatant example of targeting communities where you're not supposed to have a voice. I'm not going to have it here, but it's communities of color and it's a really dirty project. What's your involvement and do you have any hope that it can be stopped?
The Dakota Pipeline has really been led by and really the strategy and the work has been led by the indigenous community. And we have been showing up and holding up the leadership that has been done by the Indigenous Environmental Network and the tribal leaders who have been there. Our founder, Van Jones, has spoken very publicly and loudly about the need for us to stop the project from happening. We've done a lot raising the profiles of the leaders on the ground. And again, here I think our work is, how do we support people who's doing this work? Because it's not about, it's about making sure that the people who are really on the ground are the ones who are telling us where to go and how
right,
to support them.
Right, how we can help them. How we can help them. And not, you know, one of the things, I did this presentation today at lunch and a woman came up to me and said, you know, she's been in a very bad space since the election and asked me a couple of questions. And I said, the most important thing that you have to do is keep showing up. Whatever your issues are, don't get tired of signing petitions. Don't get tired of showing up at elected officials' offices. Don't get tired of marching. We have to have staying power. And I think you're saying the same thing. We're in support of the fight that the indigenous people are having for their sacred land. How can we help you?
exactly right. I want to touch on what you just said about keep going and keep staying in the fight. One of the things that I was reminded of right after the election, where so many people were terrified about what was going to happen with the climate. And, you know, he had talked about taking, you know, moving us away from the Paris Climate Treaty and, you know, helping to end the EPA. I know there was a lot of fear. And there's a famous psychologist, the woman who documented the five stages of grief. She said, there's only two emotions in the world. There's love and there is fear. And fear is the anxiety, the stress, the nervousness, the depression. And as long as you're there, you can never be in the place of love, which is the breeding ground for solutions and creativity and compassion and empathy. And those two emotions are mutually exclusive. So we have to fight, but we have to fight not from a place of fear, but from a place of love. How do we begin to understand that this is not about what do we have to move us against and who do we fight against, but what are we fighting for? And this climate fight is about fighting for the sustainable green economy that we all envision, that we know we can actually get to. That's what it is.
And I'm, you know, it's like I'm trying to write this down because you're a tweet waiting to happen. Some of these quotes are really important because they are what sticks in people's mind. And I can tell you personally and honestly, when you talk about things like that, it helps me. Love is a breeding ground for change. So I get fearful and I get shut down and I get, you know, filled with tears. And then I pull myself back up and say, you know what? Let's fight the good fight. And you're so right. Not against anything. Don't be anti. But we are for preserving that sacred land. And we are for clean air. And I remember hearing Sipora Berman at a social venture network presentation several years ago. And she talked about the Dakota Access Pipeline. She said, this should never happen. Like, never happen. And started with, we don't need it. We don't need that. It's like, it's all about money for a pipeline that we really don't need. That is, you know, we can go into the tar sands, but thank you for reminding us of that. What are we fighting for? What are the things we believe in? And certainly with this healthcare bill, don't think your power doesn't work. It was wonderful. And most people were fighting for a healthcare plan that was more inclusive, most people, and that would not harm our country and people that need to get taken care of. So that's a really good one to talk about. What about coal mines? Coal mines from the Climate Reality Project that I went to about a month ago with Al Gore's, you know, his leadership training program. The numbers of coal mines closing, not because of any, you know, higher ground and they're polluting. They're not making economic sense with the price of solar going down and the proliferation of solar manufacturing. Solar's cheaper. Natural gas is cheaper. And that's another conversation. Why is Washington now, I'm going to ask you, like, can you solve this question in the interim? Why is Washington now leading the charge to make sure the coal mines are reopened? It's like for whose benefit? Not the coal miners.
Not based in law, you know, because there are now more jobs in solar than there are in coal.
Yes. Yes.
And, yeah. The other day I was in a cab and a guy waiting for, and the lines were taking a while, and he said, hey, if you're going to the airport, can I hop in? But yeah, hop in. And it turns out that he was a coal miner from Australia, who was just there visiting. And we had this great conversation where he was talking about what it's like on a coal mine and what the industry looks like and how Australia is doing now with the coal industry, which is similar to what we're seeing in the U.S. And he turns to me and he pauses and he says, look, I want you to know that you're not my biggest threat to my job. My biggest threat to my job is robotics and self-driving cars, this automation thing that's happening. The vehicles on coal mines now are being self-driven. You know, these drilling machines are automated. And so people are losing their jobs across the board. And we have to figure out how do we actually create better jobs and more jobs, not depending on a dying coal industry that's costing us so much money and health, subsidies just to maintain them. But how do we create real jobs and vibrant industries in coal country? That's what we have to figure out.
And you're right. It's just a short-term solution. And it's like, okay, why do we want people to go back to the mines? Their life expectancy is much shorter. The incidence of, you know, lung cancer, bladder cancer, kidney and colon cancer, I mean, leukemia, everything I ever look up are all higher than in non-mining areas. So just, I mean, it's not just the coal miners that go in there and risk their health every day, but the surrounding communities. I mean, coal mining is a killer. I don't even know who refutes that.
Yeah, and we're forced to have to choose right now in this national narrative. We're told by politicians, you have to choose between whether you want a job or clean air.
Yes. And, you know, it's like, okay, yeah, frustration level high. And, you know, you bring up an interesting point, which was discussed a lot at this Climate Reality Project. Robots are replacing, they're going to displace millions and already have and will continue to displace workers. And there's the job industry now is a lot in tech, solar, green energy. And it begs the question, why aren't we retraining people at minimal cost to get out of those dying jobs and help build the strong green economy that you have the vision for? I don't understand that either.
One of the programs that we have as part of Dream Corps, which is another, or it's, I'm the deputy CEO of Dream Corps and the CEO of Green for All. And Dream Corps, which is our platform, has a program called Yes, We Code. And we train young people to connect jobs in Silicon Valley. We were able to help move from, you know, a $20,000 job getting a $75,000 job after a few months of training. And that's entirely feasible. You know, it's people who can have these jobs, high school, maybe a little bit of college degree, and leapfrog ahead into the new economy. And a lot of these solar jobs, they're engineering jobs, they're coding jobs. And I know that our programs out there for older adults, for mothers, for people of color, for girls, and it's not rocket science. Really, it feels daunting at first hearing the words, but we've all done hard work before, and we sit through a few months of training, and that actually can be a way for us to understand the new economy and be plugged into it.
And it's not like it's an intensive, you know, hugely expensive job training. I mean, really and truly, it's not like you need expensive equipment and you have to have, you know, tall buildings. And it to me, it's a clean job. And when you look at the statistics, the national statistics of where the jobs are, that's where they are. It's in the future, in tech, in, you know, if my grandson, I tell him, Liam, you should just learn how to create your own games, because the gamers are like, he can do stuff on with his little gizmo that I'm like, what did you just do? So it's, you know, the brain training and replacing humans at light speed, but there are other things. And it's what you said, what do we love? What can we move towards that's going to systemically change things? Okay, let's talk about the next one in a little bit more depth. And you mentioned it briefly. You know, you talk about cleaning up vehicle pollution. And we'll probably have to do this in two parts because, again, we're going to come up on a break in about a minute, which just blows me away. Wasn't this just a five-minute segment? But the transportation sector is one of the largest contributors to air pollution. And I believe it represents about a quarter of greenhouse gases in our United States. I can get that out. Do you have a vision for a national strategy to actually curb vehicle pollution? Because what you're doing in these communities that are so solution-focused, that restore air quality, that make electric vehicles accessible, you know, one of my favorite words, is this scalable? Can you help with other communities that are, you know, at the same place and see them as getting to another place for cleaner air?
Yeah, transportation is so important because it's actually the one part of the economy that is growing in pollution, and the energy in the building sector is getting smaller and the transportation one is going up.
Yes.
And so that's focus on transportation.
And it's huge. And again, where are the freeways where all of the lower income people live? I mean, it's like just so there's more asthma and they can't breathe clean air and the trucks are going by and, you know, the beat goes on. So changing that changes everything. When we come back, some heavy duty conversations about the impact of climate change on all of this. It's a really big web, and Vien Trong has some thoughts on the impact of climate change as a force behind this. Stay here with us. We will be right back.
Mrs. Green's World's mission is to preserve the planet by creating a global community of people who care about the health of the Earth. We educate, inform, and inspire. Mrs. Green's World is an independent, non-political, agenda-free voice. Your generous gift enables all of us to explore the issues facing the health of the planet in a comprehensive way. As a Mrs. Green's World sustainer, you can assist us in offering trusted information, providing listeners with the tools to make their own conclusions and choose their own steps to create a healthier planet. Visit MrsGreensWorld.com and click on Become a Member today.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. Thank you for being a part of this world. We are spending this hour with Vien Trong, who is the director of Green for All. And believe me when I say she has worked tirelessly to bring equity, social justice, and climate justice to the front lines of the environmental movement and public policy. She has been a central force in putting environmental justice at the center of California's groundbreaking climate policy, legislation, and cap and trade funding, and has led the charge for change to eliminating systemic injustice in other places throughout the country. Vien, once again, thank you for taking time out of your changing the world busy schedule to share with us some of your really important views and experiences.
My pleasure, Gina. It's so good to be here.
It's inspiring to me, I can tell you right now. There's a couple things I'd like to end with in this last segment. I think one of the biggest surprises to me, who kind of came late to the climate change party, late in life, I think I was being prepared for it my whole life in retrospect, but the fact that it really is a very big web. And when I say that, what I mean, there is an overriding cause and effect that is typically not in the conversation about things like starvation, political unrest, displacement of millions of people. I mean, in my opinion, it could be the cause could be made that a reason for the birth of something like ISIS came out of a place of displacement and starvation and lack of water and those things. So from your perspective, how big is the impact on a lot of these things? Climate change, you know, of things that you see around the world in our country.
When Syria's refugee crisis broke the news, Prince William said this was because of climate change. And what he meant by that is Syria's rural farm workers had been going through a drought, and it had gotten increasingly worse, and there was no help given to the farm workers. And so their families had to begin resettlement into the city centers. And that was when the tension surfaced. And that led to many families having to try to find help on other shores. And they got out, they got in boats, like my family did from Vietnam, and many didn't make it. That was because of climate change, and that was the connection to refugees. Now, the UN has said that if we don't do something dramatic, by the time we get to 2050, we're going to see 200 million climate refugees.
Oh, just imagine that. 200 million. I mean, and where are we going to put them? Who's going to feed them? Talk about death and violence. I mean, that number is staggering to me. 200 million by 2050, which, of course, is just around the corner. It's just what's going to happen. Okay, I'm writing that down too. Oh, hit the alarm bell.
It's alarming. But, you know, it also should be something that motivates us, because it shouldn't be about, well, let's figure out how do we prepare for it. Let's figure out how do we prevent it. right? Let's figure out how to begin working together to understand we're all connected by climate change. Whether we're the ones who have to get in boats or whether we're the ones who are going to be receiving, we got to figure out what to do. And the impact around the refugee crisis is also going to be something that affects our economy. You know, arguably, this has been an underpinning of what we've seen in Europe and European Union with the Brexit exit, with the ongoing move to populism, a conservative populism by France and by Germany. And it's an issue that has effects on the global climate change investments and on aid and on the policies that they create.
And it's huge. One of the things that never ceases to amaze me, I mean, we are a global community. It's not my opinion. We are a global community. Everything's connected. What happens in Africa has an impact on us. And to me, it's like what I am working for is a world that works for everyone, because if it does, it works for me too. I mean, it's not necessarily this, you know, high road, lofty, world that works for everyone. If it is, that means it's working for me as well. And it's worth heading in that direction. What about
I was just going to say, I want to bring that home, because what you're saying there is so important. We've been talking here today about pollution and poverty and worker security. Well, these all reflect policies that have prioritized profits over people. You know, it's the corporations that need raw materials that strip the landmines and they blow off the mountaintops to get the coal and they frack in our backyards, causing scars in the earth. It's the policies that hire workers as cheaply as possible in sweatshops that leaves behind people broken by the industrial injuries and the debts and the deterioration. It's the workers that are being paid so low that they have to rely on subsidies even while their employers are getting massive amounts of tax breaks. You know, it's for the production that they're creating that is as cheap as possible that leaves behind toxic waste in our backyards, dumping that waste into the marginalized communities that have no power in search of more profits that these executives and investors are leaving behind the poor who are broken by the high levels of healthcare costs, the high levels of healthy food, and the impossibility now of even getting a decent home. These things are all interconnected. But I will say that the solutions for that is also very interconnected, and that's where the great hope is.
That is where the great hope is. And when we're talking about coal miners, I don't want to come across as, well, let's close those mines, let's do this. Those people, we have one coming here in Arizona, the Navajo plant, and for that reservation, that's the jobs. I mean, those are the jobs, and that's how people feed their families and, you know, clothe them, and it's awful. And then a lot of them don't even have electricity, many of them, or running water. It's such a disgrace that I can't even get my head around it. I care about those people because I do want a world that works for everyone. But what are we going to do to help them once we close those mines? Because it's not good for them either. Talk about healthcare issues. We're not doing something great for them by opening the coal mine so they have a job. It isn't great.
Mm-hmm. Right now, there's a lot that people can do. So let me start by saying I completely agree with you about the important role that coal miners have had. I mean, the fact that you and I can go to our light switch and turn it on.
Yes.
People sacrifice their lives for that. And it's been generations of people who have sacrificed their lives and their health. And now they're left behind. Their healthcare costs are being cut. Their employers aren't covering the cost that they need. You know, they're not able to afford healthy foods and groceries. Those stores have left their communities. It's only leaving behind fast food chains, which is causing an ongoing problem of health. So I feel like we need to do a lot more. And what we can do, there's legislation that's happening next month in D.C., and we can do a lot to pick up the phone and call our congressmen and our senators and say, we want to make sure that coal miners have adequate pensions, have economies that we're investing in building a new economy in coal country, that we're allowing for a budget that helps them transition from their old jobs to new jobs and provides them the training and the centers that they need in order for them to do that.
And it, again, reiterate, repeat, press repeat, reiterate, sign petitions, go to see your elected officials. And of course, me, more importantly, when I'm thinking about what can I do, is make sure that a lot of the scenario changes in the election in 2018, which, oh, by the way, is just around the corner. It's like, okay, let's see what we can do about that. But stay in the game. And, you know, you can't solve everything, but pick your causes. I think it can't be one cause anymore. You have to at least have a couple in there because of so many things that are going on. Can you talk a little bit about, we use the term institutional racism, and I'd love you to explain a little bit more from your view, you know, what is that and how can we not just change it, but help identify it? It's not always like an intentional, it's not someone being racist. It's so much deeper and more complex than that. So talk us a little bit to us a little bit about institutional racism.
Yeah, well, first let's unpack the word racism. And there are different kinds. There's the kind of racism that it's, you know, from one person to another, interpersonal.
Right.
And it can be, you know, anything to hateful words to other things. And then there's the organizational or structural ones where, you know, there's a company and they may have a practice of not promoting somebody because of the color of their skin. Well, that would be an organization or company racism. And then there's the institutional or structural ones that are greater than that, systemic racism. And that's where we have policies in place that says, well, if you are, by virtue of the color of your skin, you can't have a mortgage of this quality. You can't have access to these programs. You can't have access to, you know, certain industries or jobs completely. And that not only has been the case in the past, but there are still some instances of that, right? Access to schools in the nice areas.
Right.
And those things are where we begin to see the insidiousness of really causing a segregation between the have and the have-nots by the color of their skin rather than by the character of the person, as Dr. King talked about it.
Right. And making...
And, you know,
go ahead.
I was just going to say that a lot of times now, when you think about communities that are most poisoned, that are most disadvantaged or marginalized, when you begin to picture who they are, you kind of already know that they're people of color and low income and that they live in these certain areas. It's because we all understand the structural and institutional racism, even if we can't put a finger on it.
And it goes deeper than just, you know, where the railroads go through, where we do the mining, where we put the pipeline. I think every single documentary I've watched about where the most heinous factories are for turkeys, chickens, pigs, they're in where? Oh, where are they? Oh, that's right, marginalized communities, because the access to cheap labor. And it's all just a horrible, ugly manipulation of people in need. And it goes deeper. And we don't know. I don't want to know where my chicken comes from. And I'm not saying that anymore. Believe me, I know if I bite a piece of chicken, I want to know where it came from. But it is so insidious that there's a lot more to be uncovered in terms of, you know, bringing about that much needed change. So let's ask, this is my personal, it's a personal question, and I'm not going to put you on the spot, so don't worry. I'm sure you've been asked it before. What are you fighting for? You, Vien Trang, what is it that motivates you? These are painful, ugly challenges on any given day. I have shut the world out at times just from what I'm doing in my work for, you know, raising the consciousness of people on the planet. What are you fighting for?
Many things. I mean, I'm fighting for my kids and their lives, which is projected to be 12 years less because of where we live. But more importantly, for me, this isn't just a fight about the biggest ecological crisis of all time. It's a fight for a new economy, a new energy system, a new democracy, a new relationship to the planet and to each other, for land and food and water rights and sovereignty for indigenous people, for human rights and dignity for all. For me, this fight is about winning the world that we want. It's not about being having too much to lose. It's about having so much to gain. When we do this right, we can transform our economies. We can rebuild the world that we want. and we can begin revisioning how we are with each other and how we show up for each other. And that begins with a foundation of fighting for others as much as we fight for ourselves.
And just what a great answer. I mean, what an inspirational answer. And do you think that a part of that is, and I hope I can get this out right, but part of what is, you said, you know, profit over people, profit over planet. Do you think that we can ever see a shift where the race for more changes to I have enough? I had a guest on my show recently, and she just said, I just want to be able to, you know, live in my little house, have enough to take care of my daughter, and go on trips. So I don't want to make millions. I just want to have enough. And that's a mindset shift. She's not trying to save for the bigger house and save for the bigger car and accumulate more stuff. Do you think that that is a good thing to consider as part of our vision? It certainly impacted me.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, there are so many studies that says after you make over 100,000, anything you make of millionaires, they're not much happier. But what gives people immediate and much bigger happiness is how they show up for others. And that gives me a lot of hope.
It's just so affirming when you get involved in this work. It's you know, one of the things of which I am most proud is an ongoing mentor program. We worked with these kids when they're in third grade, and now they're 26 and 27. And people say, oh my gosh, it was so wonderful that you did that, and on and on. And I look at them and I say, and the reward was all mine. Because it changed my life. It changed the life of our entire family, thinking I was doing this good thing for this at-risk group of kids. And now, you know, they're texting me that we went on trips with them. It's like, thank you for letting me into your fabulous, wonderful, strong, incredible world. You know what I mean? It's like, yeah, the surprise could be all yours. So I guess I want to, this is another tough one for me and a cause of great debate among in my family and my loved ones and close friends that we seem to talk about little else. In terms of environmental justice and the battle to, you know, slow down climate change or, in my opinion, reverse it, and human rights, all of these things that we're fighting for, social justice and equity, do you think that what's happening with the war on all of those things, in my opinion, against us, you know, let's go to war about climate change. Today is an epic day. Executive orders to rescind the Clean Power Act. Do you think the possibility is that we're going to sit back and say, wasn't this great? This is getting us in touch with what really matters to us. This is how we're going to bring about lasting substantive change. What's your spin on that piece? Because some days it doesn't feel like that to me.
Yeah, I think just when we get onslaughts like the one that we had today, cutting the Clean Power Plan and others, you know, it's hard. But what I'm reminded of is if you go around and just take a random poll and say, how are you feeling? Are you feeling more motivated than you were before the election to do some change, to really get engaged in politics, to really show up in testimonies, I mean, in hearings and testify? Most people would say yes. They're more engaged.
It's so true.
Yeah.
It's so true. Oh, my gosh. I went to a luncheon last Saturday for Arizona's List, which is like Emily's List. And I came out of there, I sounded kind of like a football player going, yeah, yeah, we can do this. Yeah, I was like so pumped up. I was laughing.
Yeah. Remember those pictures of the Women's March around the globe where people were showing up?
Yes.
I mean, we're seeing that energy. And, you know, I think that there's a beautiful reminder that in our darkest moments, we should remember we're not alone.
We are so not alone.
Yeah.
That is a great point. And I cannot think of an hour more well spent than this one. And I hope that I get to cross paths with you. I had my picture taken with Van Jones. Do not tell him this, even though thousands of people will hear it. And like, it will never go away. I pull it out and show people. I'm like, oh yeah, there's Van Jones and Mrs. Green at a conference. So it was a thrill for me. And For all the right reasons. For all the right reasons. I asked him a question about something and he gave me a really important answer. So I'm going to end the show in a hurry. Mike Baruch, The Future of Our Home Part 2, and Jessica Swiden from Synchronicity Earth coming up. Bien, thank you so much for showing up in my world, for what you do, and everybody, make it a great green, intentionally lived week.
Yes, thank you.